It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Often when you hear about Arctic ice melting, it's used as an example of climate change and environmental damage. However, according to a recent article in Foreign Affairs magazine, environmental degradation isn't the only outcome of the Arctic thaw.
As the ice retreats, the Arctic is set for an economic boom with lots of natural resources and new shipping routes.
Here with us to discuss this is Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs magazine, and we'll be joined also by Michael Levy, senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book The Power Surge. Later in the hour, Michael will stay with us as we talk about the future of energy in America. Thanks for joining us, Stuart and Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to start out by asking Stuart, when we take a look at the Arctic and the idea of an ice-free Arctic, I did a little reading on this, and the timeline for that is moving up and moving up really, really fast. What are we looking at right now?
According to the article by Scott Borgerson, satellite observations have moved the date for a ice-free Arctic summer up till 2035, and some have even suggested that it may happen as soon as 2020. So it's melting as was expected, but way faster. At a way faster rate than most people predicted.
And without putting too fine a point on it, 2020 is practically around the corner.
Right. I mean, last summer, the Arctic Ocean was covered by the smallest portion of ice since record-keeping began in 1979.
Now, many of the people who focus on this topic talk about the toll it will take on the Arctic ecosystem and the Earth's environment as a whole. Now, Stuart, the article you edited for Foreign Affairs takes a look at some of the other aspects of this thaw, and in a sense, it's not all bad news, depending on how you look at it.
That's right. I mean, Borgerson's clear that environmentally, it'd be better if we could avoid global warming, but given that it's happening, he points out that there are certain economic benefits to be had. The Arctic is a region home to some 22% of the world's undiscovered conventional oil and gas deposits. There are a lot of minerals to be had there, and there are all sorts of other ancillary economic activity that may soon be taking place in the Arctic as the ice melts and the region really opens up.
Now, Michael Levy, this is probably a good time to bring you into the conversation. I heard Stuart just say 22% of oil and gas reserves might wind up being in the Arctic. How are oil companies responding to this? Are they responding to it the way I think they would?
There's certainly been interest in developing oil and gas in the Arctic. When you have reserves and resources that big, there's no question that oil and gas companies become interested in them. But the reality is that it's an extraordinarily challenging environment to operate in. Even if we were to see largely ice-free summers, we would still have ice much of the year and unpredictable ice coverage that gets in the way of being able to plan development. On top of that, the environmental protections that are rightly in place for operations up there make it more expensive to develop the oil, and when there are cheaper opportunities elsewhere, companies pursue those. We saw Shell attempt to pursue some offshore Arctic exploration last year and ran into major problems with its operations and had to pull back without being able to move forward.
And, of course, we're talking on the one hand about minerals and oil and natural gas and so forth. But, you know, in the search for cheap transportation, people have been looking for the Northwest Passage for centuries. And I read an article a couple of months ago that you can get through there right now. It's a lot of work, but it can be done. And so, Michael, let's follow up with you on this a little bit in terms of transportation and shipping and all those things that affect world commerce. It changes the ballgame there a little bit.
It certainly has the potential to do that. Right now, you still can't plan your operations around the expectation that you are going to be able to consistently steam through a newly opened up Northwest Passage. We certainly have been looking for something like that for a long time, and it would cut transport distances from the Arctic and from North America to Asia, or to parts of Asia at least, considerably. But it's going to be a while before these become established routes that really change the game. Again, because the predictability is tough. You can't just take a straight line from the melting that's been happening in recent years and draw it out into the future. We are much better at projecting future temperature increases, even future impacts on violent storms and precipitation. Sea level, those are big things that worry us. The melting of the Arctic is a far more complex system and far more difficult to make projections about.
Stuart, let's go back to you for a second, because as we talk about resources, the potential for increased transportation, it brings in a lot of questions about who owns what, who gets what, who gets to profit when all of this stuff happens. So what is the situation? Who owns, and I put quotations around that, who owns the Arctic?
Well, one of the things that Borgerson points out in his article is that, you know, just a few years ago, most experts, including himself, were predicting that the scramble for the Arctic would get possibly even violent over these issues, but certainly conflictual over the question of territory and disputed claims. However, as he writes, these have largely been settled peacefully, and countries are kind of sorting out the various claims over the seabed in the Arctic. So whereas one might have expected that the newfound wealth would lead to a intense competition among great power politics, instead we've seen a much more peaceful process, he argues.
And you talk in the article about a lot of the relationships that exist in that part of the world. But it was interesting to note that the United States, I don't remember the exact phrase, but the United States is not exactly active in this game right now.
Right. According to Borgerson, the United States risks being left behind in the Arctic, and that other countries, such as China, namely, have really ramped up investment and started taking an acute interest in the region. Just to name one figure, Russia has 30 icebreakers, Canada has 13, and the United States, by contrast, only has 3 icebreakers, 2 of which are operative. So Borgerson argues that it's time for American policymakers to start making the Arctic a priority and having a thought-out national strategy for it, and also kind of doing some of the more detailed policy changes that need to take place if the region's bounties are to be truly harnessed.
And the article points out that China is already taking steps in certainly the diplomatic regards. They mention increased visits to Reykjavik in Iceland. And for China to be in Iceland several times in the last couple of years says something, and it does beg the question, where is the U.S. in all this?
Right. I mean, in part, what you're seeing from China is a continuation of its policy worldwide. The same thing could be said of its investment in Africa. But I think Borgerson's main point is that if the United States doesn't act and start getting its act together in the Arctic, China is going to be winning the day there, and other countries that have more solid presences there are going to be dominating, and that would be a shame given the United States' access to the Arctic via Alaska.
And given the fact that 2020 is not too awfully far away, they got to get going. As you look at the political landscape today, do you see that sort of interest in the Arctic? It seems like there's everything in the world is being discussed in American government right now except this.
Well, I think the Arctic is never it has a harder time raising to the level where it's on policymakers' front burners. You know, with events in the Middle East that require the administration to react to, it's hard to imagine the Arctic becoming the subject of most of the White House's meetings. However, this May, the White House released a National Strategy for the Arctic Region, a document that kind of is a promising start, Borgerson calls it, and kind of updates the previous strategy that had been issued under the Bush administration. So I think if Borgerson might say that they're promising signs that the United States government is starting to take this more seriously, but I think he would also say that it has a long way to go.
Well, and I think that's a good place to leave it for the moment. We've been speaking with Stuart Reed and Michael Levy. Stuart is a senior editor at Foreign Affairs magazine. Michael is the senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. Next, we'll be taking a check of the headlines, and when we return, we'll continue speaking with Michael Levy about the future of energy in America. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're back with Michael Levy, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. We're going to take a few minutes now and talk about what that future of energy looks like. Michael, in your book, you talk about what you call two parallel energy revolutions in the United States. How do you define these?
We've seen extraordinary turnarounds across the board in American energy. If you ask someone 5-7 years ago what would be happening to American oil and gas production, they would say it'll keep going the way it has been forever. It'll keep going down. Instead, we've seen a boom in oil production, the biggest one-year increase in history last year, rising natural gas production, gas passed coal as the top domestic source of energy in 2011. At the same time, if you would have asked someone 5 years ago, 7 years ago, what will happen to U.S. oil consumption, they would say, well, that will continue going up and we'll become ever more dependent on oil. Instead, U.S. oil consumption peaked in 2005. It's mostly headed down since then as we've used more efficient technologies and driven less and shifted to alternatives. And at the same time, we've seen big gains in renewable energy, a doubling of wind and solar generation in the last 4 years, falling prices, particularly on the solar side. All of these things are rewriting how we think about American energy and forcing us to confront what it all means for the economy, for security, for the environment.
So what does it mean? I mean, it's so interesting because I remember doing the stories on peak oil, and I remember doing the stories, you know, when gas prices started to go up on the future, the bright future of renewable energy. And all of that has since turned into, I don't know, sort of a partisan issue. You know, if we start talking about anything with fossil fuels, it turns into this partisan divide, and the same with renewables. So is one side going to win this, or are these revolutions, you know, in both of these two revolutions going to unfold sort of simultaneously?
Well, they can unfold simultaneously, but if political history is any guide, we're going to see a lot more fighting before that happens. If you look back, and when I was writing the book, I looked back into history, and I found that we seem to be living through the second time around for a lot of the fights we're engaging in. In the aftermath of the first oil crisis in 1973, we actually moved forward on multiple fronts. We increased production in Alaska, but we cut our consumption with the first fuel economy rules. And both sides embraced all of these developments. But by the late 1970s, we got locked into a zero-sum fight where one side said, we want fossil fuels and more of them, and the other side says, we want alternatives and we want to use less energy. And they use that as a proxy for much bigger ideological fights, much bigger fights about the role that government should have in society. And for the next couple decades after that, things mostly went south. We ignored a lot of our energy predicament, and then it all came back with a vengeance in the last decade. First, the events in the world, the 9/11 attacks, Hurricane Katrina, skyrocketing gasoline prices that hurt people in their pocketbooks. And then we saw these transformations in American energy on both sides. Now we've returned to that third piece of the historical pattern. We're having the same fights. If you like oil and gas, you say we don't need to be focusing on renewables and on cutting our consumption. If you think we should be cutting our consumption and ultimately transitioning to zero carbon fuels, you think that oil and gas production are a distraction. If you do the analysis, if you look at what's happening on the ground, and if you look at the numbers, you'll find that we actually can make simultaneous gains on these different fronts. And the logic is different for each piece, and you have to dig into that. It's not just about slogans. You actually have to see how the pieces can fit together. But we actually can get gains from these different sources at the same time.
And it sounds like the Obama administration has changed its stance on this somewhat. More lately, we're hearing about oil, natural gas being sort of a bridge to renewables, where, you know, 3-4 years ago, renewables were the way. But does that stance satisfy anybody who holds some of these views that it's either one or the other?
It's fascinating. If you look at the Democratic Party platform on energy from last year, it looks very similar to John McCain's platform on energy from 2008. More production, more environmental protection, price on carbon. A lot of the pieces are similar. So the president certainly has shifted over time. Right now, playing the all of the above card like the president does is politically challenging. When the president went out last summer and pushed hard on all of the above, people who liked wind and solar said, what's wrong with this guy? Why is he pushing oil and gas? People who liked oil and gas said, this guy says he likes alternatives to oil. He must hate what we're doing. So pushing that message through when what everyone hears is he likes my enemy rather than he's actually supporting what it is that I want to have happen is really tough.
And that seems to me sort of the crux of this argument and many arguments regarding the government and Congress these days is there aren't a lot of simple answers. And this strikes me as being one of those situations where the answer is not necessarily simple. Events are unfolding and you know, it may be the same or different paces. And everybody wants things to be simple, but it just can't.
I think that's right. I think at the same time, whatever government does, a lot of these trends are being driven by forces beyond government. They're being driven by high prices for fuel. They're being driven by technological change. And so regardless of what's done in Washington, the developments on the ground will have impacts for people's jobs, for our security. When you're in Wisconsin, the development of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling technology as a combination in Texas has been used in Pennsylvania to extract natural gas, which is having an impact on sand mining in Wisconsin. And government regulations will shift that. They'll affect that. They'll steer those dynamics in different ways. But those dynamics will unfold regardless.
And as you researched your book, you mentioned that you were, I don't know if you were in Wisconsin, but you got around the country quite a bit. How is the country a different place in terms of energy production, of energy awareness, than it may have been 5 or 10 years ago?
You're certainly seeing people grapple with energy production in places and in forms that they weren't used to. And they're starting to understand the ins and outs. I think 3 years ago, when shale gas development came to Pennsylvania, people didn't know what to make of it. They weren't prepared. The regulators weren't as ready as they should have been. The communities weren't as ready either. Now, as you see it migrate into other places like Ohio, people are more prepared. They're learning from experience. What the regulators are learning, the communities are learning. This is happening in other parts of energy, too. People are becoming more familiar with energy-efficient vehicles. They're shifting to those even without the push from regulation. Regulation is taking that further as people internalize these high prices, as they realize that they are with us to stay. And you see also fights on the ground in other energy technologies. One of the people I met with when I was writing the book was an environmental filmmaker who got very upset when wind farm development was done poorly in her town in upstate New York. It wasn't set back far enough from the homes and caused a lot of problems there. Now, I don't want to compare renewable energy to some of the potential risks that you see in oil and gas, but everyone is adapting to this changing landscape. Everyone is in some ways facing up to it for the first time, or at least a new phenomena for the first time.
We've only got about a minute left and a big question. So is the U.S. going to become energy independent? And the second part of that is, does it matter if we do?
Well, you've posed the question exactly right. North America might ultimately produce as much oil as it consumes, and that's what a lot of people have called energy independence for a long time. But the reality is that we're part of a global market. If things go haywire in the Middle East, oil prices spike there and they spike here, and we get hurt as an economy as a result. And that will be on the minds of American leaders every time they decide whether to take action on the other side of the world. We may become more self-sufficient. We will have economic gains as a result. We will have security changes as a result. But I do not see us becoming independent in the way a lot of people have rightly hoped for the last 40 years.
Well, Michael Levy, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been speaking with Michael Levy, a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future.
Next is the news, and then we'll hear an update on today's violence in Egypt. And don't forget, you can keep track of us, find out what's happening, maybe check out some videos and links on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in this week, filling in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret this week. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll be talking about how smartphone apps that make bird calls could actually be harming the birds. But first, the violence following the ousting of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi continues.
A week after the Egyptian military gave President Morsi and the opposition 48 hours to plan a way forward for the country, Morsi's out of power, and today reports say at least 51 Morsi supporters have been killed by the Egyptian military. Here with us to discuss is Marina Ottaway, senior scholar for the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you so much for joining us again, Marina.
You're welcome.
Well, so last Monday you joined us on Central Time, and at that point the Egyptian military had given Morsi and the opposition this 48-hour ultimatum. And a week later, the situation has taken a dramatic turn. What's going on the ground today?
Well, the situation is now exactly the opposite of what it was then. At that point, a week ago, you had the Muslim Brotherhood in power and a largely secular opposition agitating in the streets. Today, you have essentially what used to be the secular opposition backed by the military in power and not quite finding a way to put together a government. And Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and other Islamist groups demonstrating in the streets.
And, of course, today we have this report that at least 51 people were killed when the Egyptian military opened fire on a group of Morsi supporters who were demonstrating, praying outside where they believe that he's being held. Now, there are conflicting reports about what happened, but we do know that 51 people at least have been killed. So what is the effect of that violence going to be, and what is it already, do you think?
Well, I think it's polarizing the country even more. You see it from the way in which the news has been reported. For example, the National Salvation Front, which is the main alliance of secular groups, completely bought the narrative of the military, that is, that these were violent armed groups that were about to storm the Revolutionary Guard, the Presidential Guard barracks. The Islamists and their supporters argued that it was an unprovoked attack by the military at a time in which the demonstrators were actually down on their knees for the morning prayer. Without having been there, I don't know who is right, but what I know is that there was one military officer killed, and there were at least 51 demonstrators killed. So that does tend to support the idea that there was no large-scale armed attack by the Muslim Brothers.
Now, a concern that all of this has started to raise is that with a government still not in place, with violence escalating on the ground, people are starting to worry about a civil war. What does that look like to you right now?
Well, I think there is certainly going to be continued violence and unrest in the country, and it will continue for quite a while, particularly if they do not succeed in creating a government of national reconciliation. This is what the military said at the beginning. This looks increasingly unlikely in the short run because the military has taken is siding with the secular groups against the Islamists to begin with. And because after the violence this morning, some of the Islamist parties that initially accepted the takeover by the military, like An-Nur, are now saying that they are going to stop their participation in that government. So it's going to be very difficult to put together a government of national reconciliation.
Now, I want to talk about the military for a moment. You said they were aligning with the secularists. Does that mean that the military itself is comprised mostly of secularists, or is that a more mixed group than we suppose?
Well, that is that's a big problem, and we do not know. Certainly, the evidence seems to indicate that the high-ranking officers are predominantly secularist, but it is very unlikely that this is true of the rest of the military, certainly the rank and file. Keep in mind that there are a lot of, this is there is a draft in Egypt, so a lot of the soldiers are draftees, and probably there is a large number of Muslim Brothers among them because they are part of Egyptian society. So one of the real dangers to me is that if this continues, the military itself might end up splitting.
Mm. Well, what happens then? What happens if the military splits?
Well, that's a very good question. It's going to make the situation much, much worse. And unfortunately, what makes me rather pessimistic certainly for the short run, is the fact that the military leaders, the generals, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, it's the same group that was in power from 2011 to the summer of 2012. And they did not give any signs of being particularly astute politically. And we have the same group that are trying to steer the second transition now.
Now, the interim president has made motions to fill the slots of vice president and prime minister. Where does that stand right now?
Well, that does not stand anywhere because he has not succeeded, because the first recommendation for the post of prime minister was Mohamed El-Baradei, and that was a very unwise choice because El-Baradei was the most important figure in the secular opposition, so that by choosing El-Baradei, the president essentially was choosing a partisan figure and not somebody who could lead a government of technocrats. El-Baradei is out of the running because An-Nur party made it quite clear that they would not accept him. There has been no other nomination at this point.
So when you look at this, what's happening in Egypt, does this look to you like the birth pangs of democracy, or does this look like a country that's out of control and spiraling down a different road?
Well, you know, I think the birth pains of democracy have been quite ugly in all countries. You know, you can look at the French Revolution and say, well, that was certainly not very promising. Today, everybody will look at the French Revolution as the beginning of that process. But it's a process that took half a century to be accomplished. So there is, it certainly would be wrong to say there is no hope for Egypt ever having democracy. But it's certainly Egypt, it's not going to be a democratic country in the next few years. This is just the beginning of a very long process, but it's likely to have some very ugly moments, as it is going through an ugly moment right now.
Well, Marina, thank you so much for joining us. We'll keep an eye on this one. Thank you.
You are most welcome.
We've been speaking with Marina Ottaway, Senior Scholar for the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.
Coming up next, we'll be checking news headlines, and then we'll hear how birdsong apps are creating a stir in the woods and in the birding community. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you're heading out to do some bird watching this summer, you might be tempted to bring along that smartphone and get better results. And if you've got a birdsong app loaded up, you'll have instant access to the songs and calls from just about every species on the globe.
And I have to say, that makes it pretty easy to attract just the bird you're looking for. Earlier today, we recorded Veronica in the woods with her smartphone app.
Was
well, actually,
in the
we didn't. She was in the studio. She's in the studio
now. I was in the
now.
Office.
I was going to try to do crickets, but I can't. So
this is a little taste of what, you know, if I were looking for the Civita Capo Grosso Boreal Owl, this is what I'd hear when I played my smartphone.
All right, sounds pretty handy, right? But our next guest says what this really is a slippery slope, and there are some very serious issues raised when thousands of amateur bird watchers set out into the wild, into the woods, with these birdsong apps.
Mel White is a regular contributor to National Geographic magazine, and he recently wrote the piece, The Ethical Flap Over Birdsong Apps. Mel, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be here.
So were you familiar with that owl we just listened to?
That's a very rare species, and I've never seen it. But it was actually a good one to choose for your demonstration, because owls are some of the birds that people use these recorded calls on the most, because they're very hard to find, being nocturnal.
Right. Well, I mean, then that's just it. For bird watching is not necessarily the consequence-free romp through the woods. People get very serious about attracting birds and notching off birds on their life list. And so when you're able to call the birds in, that's an advantage. And these apps help it help make it easier to attract birds. So why is this so controversial?
Well, many times it's not controversial. A person who goes out in the woods and plays a song of an extremely common bird once or twice and attracts the bird and takes a quick look at it and leaves, in most instances, people are not going to find too much problem with that. The problem comes when a very rare bird is present or an endangered species is present, and a bird watcher really, really wants to find that bird, see that bird, to put it on their list, and they're tempted to use this the song of a bird to make it come in and appear for their binoculars. Every time you do that, it puts a little bit of stress on the bird, and again, in most instances, might not make any difference. But a rare bird that was subjected to this several times a day by birders looking for it, it could suffer some consequences.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that for a second, because what we're doing is we're playing a bird song from a smartphone app, and it sounds, you know, pretty benign if you think about it in that context. But the question I have is, so why do birds sing in the first place? And then when they're reacting to that app, what are they reacting to?
Well, a male bird is saying a couple things when he sings. First, he's saying, I'm a fit mate to potential mate, female mates. I have a good song. I've staked out a territory with good food supplies, with good habitat for us to raise a family. And then once he does have a female and they've mated, he's basically telling other males to stay out of his territory. So when he hears another song, he thinks a male is invading his territory, and he gets very agitated at times. It flies toward the source of that song to drive it away.
So he doesn't hear a bird just saying hello. He hears a threat of some kind, and he feels the need to go do something about it, and that's where some of that stress comes in.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, if this happens over, say, 10 seconds, you know, a very common bird, you know, it flies up, lets the bird watcher see it, and the bird watcher takes a look, turns off the tape, and leaves, probably doesn't cause much problem. Again, the problem comes when a lot of birders do it to a rare bird. We don't know exactly what might happen to these birds, but it does use up energy. It does take away from their feeding. And some studies have shown that, this is kind of funny, but if a male bird is not successful in driving away a rival, he may lose status with his mate, and she may go off and mate with other males.
So, in other words, if he's unsuccessful at driving away this imaginary birdsong app rival,
yes,
he's going to lose stature.
Right, right. And this happens when a birder does something that you should never do, which is play the song over and over and over for literally minutes at a time. And I think all birders have seen people do that. And I hope that the awareness of this practice is rising among birders.
Now, what is the American Birding Association's stance on this?
Well, they don't forbid it. They discourage it, and they certainly advise that it be used with discretion and in a very limited way, and never with a rare or a threatened bird.
And when is there a code of ethics for birders?
Well, not officially. Most serious birders in the United States and North America belong to the American Birding Association. It's a private group of a nonprofit group, and they do have an actual code of ethics that addresses this issue.
And really, what does that say? That you should never do it? You should just do it under limited circumstances?
Yes, under limited circumstances. They don't forbid it. There's a range of opinion on this, of course, mm-hmm. and there are people who think that it should never be done, that anything you do that puts stress on a bird is putting your sort of selfish desires to see the bird above the welfare of the bird, and they think that's totally wrong. I don't think that's the majority of birders, but there's a lot of people who think that.
Can you give me an example of some of those limited circumstances where it might be okay? Are we talking scientific research or something along those lines?
Well, the example I used in my little in the story I wrote for the National Geographic Daily News website was something that I actually did, which was I had a group of I was actually leading a beginner bird watching class. So these were people that I was hoping to get interested in bird watching, who would go on and become interested to become more avid birders. And so I was trying to make the day as entertaining as possible and show them as many birds as possible. And I played, I heard this, a common yellowthroat singing, which is an extremely common bird throughout a lot of North America. But it's very shy and it's hard to see. And I told these people to gather around me, and I played the song very quickly, maybe two or three songs over the space of, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds. The male bird popped right out, let us get a good look at it. It thrilled the people I was with, and I turned the song off and we left. I would bet any amount of money that we didn't really do any harm to this extremely common bird. So that's one instance where I think a lot of people would excuse it. It was sort of, even though I'm not a, teacher or a scientist, I did provide some good to these folks.
And you do got to wonder, if you're looking for a rare bird, is it less intrusive to the bird to do what you did, play your app once and the bird hops out, or let 50 birders in pursuit of that rare boreal owl tramp around the woods, disturbing the habitat for half an hour, which is worse?
Yep, that point has been made exactly. If you walk up to the edge of the woods, play the song of a bird, and the bird comes out to the edge of the woods, everybody gets a good look at it, everybody leaves within 30 seconds, which an ethical guide would do, or just say, look, we know there's a black rail or something in these woods. Let's all just fan out and try to find it. And people spend 10 or 15 minutes tromping around in the marsh. That could be bad.
It's got to be so tempting, though,
Oh, yeah.
There you are, the bird is there, you've got your smartphone, who's going to know if you play it? I don't know. You can see where it is, the slippery slope you describe it as.
Yeah, it's sort of like cheating at golf if you're playing by yourself. I mean, you're really tempted to kick that ball out of the bad line onto the fairway, and nobody's going to know it but you. The only trouble is, when you do that on golf, you're not hurting anything except your own sort of ethics, whereas if you do it with a bird, you may hurt the bird.
Now, you referred to this a couple of times, but ethics is sort of, that's a line that keeps moving around depending on circumstances and where you are and all those sorts of things. Do you feel like this conversation is one that is being taken seriously? Because I have to say, when you first start talking about bird calls and smartphone apps, it's got a nice, light, sort of fluffy feel to it, like there's not much here. So how do you have that conversation? How do you have people take this seriously?
Well, birders are taking it seriously. When I was researching this, I found a number of websites where there's extremely active discussion about this among some of the top birders in the country. David Sibley, who wrote one of the top field guides and is recognized as one of the top birders and ID specialists in the country, has a great website, and there's a really interesting and long discussion about this on his website from many names that I recognized from the world of birding that took all the entire spectrum of opinion, from never do it, it's bad, to it's okay for educational purposes.
So do you feel like we're reaching some sort of consensus that we're going to have some sort of answer, some sort of guidance for this within the next year or two? Or is this going to go on and on?
Oh, no, it's going to go on. I mean, let's people are fallible. And again, if you've driven 2,000 miles to see a bird, which happens a lot, and birders travel, you know, we go to the Everglades, we go to the Sierra Nevadas, we go to Alaska, you know, you spent many days traveling, possibly thousands of dollars, and there's a bird in the bushes over there that you've traveled all this way to see. This is your one shot at it. You know, everybody's going to be tempted to play that song. The only thing we can hope for is that people are aware of the issue and do it judiciously when they use the tape.
And we'll leave it there. Mel, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. It's my pleasure.
Mel White's article, The Ethical Flap Over Birdsong Apps, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking with the author of The Supper Club book. He's got some great suggestions if you live in the upper Midwest and if you're looking for a good fish fry, a good steak, a relish tray, or maybe a brandy old fashioned.
And we'll also be talking about the bicycling boom in this country. As more and more Americans are using bikes for transportation and recreation, cities are starting to rethink their relationship with bicycles, spurring a two-wheeled revolution.
We'll also hear about a new exhibit at the Historical Society and talking about the start of Ramadan.
That's all coming up and more tomorrow on Central Time.